planning 3 full days of events. And the days are themed sort of broadly around education, celebration, and resistance, following the sort of dual power structure that Occupy has promoted from its very inception. The idea of dual power is that we are not a protest, that while we are criticizing and attempting to diminish the power of these crumbling institutions that are failing society, we are also simultaneously building visions of another world. And there's many of these visions, right? So we don't have a single prescription. In fact, I think part of the idea is that the world that we want to live in does not have a single metric or a single way of deciding what is good, as this one seems to decide what is good and what is right by markets or profits rather than morals or people. And so, as it's often said, we have many yeses, but only one no. And that no is that this system is simply not working for us, and it's not working for most people on this planet. So along those lines, our events of the weekend have already begun. We've started with mass action training. So the idea is that there should be thousands of people here, many of whom are coming from around the world and around the country, many of whom have never participated in a mass action before. And so we have some globally recognized trainers who are doing outstanding work, walking people through a lot of street tactics, a lot of mobile tactics, a lot of mental preparation, the idea of breaking into affinity groups and really deciding sort of how you want to make quick decisions on the ground with people that you trust, and how to sort of imbue horizontal principles into how you act on the street and how you protest. So these have already begun, and they're happening every night from Wednesday, last night, until Sunday night. And one of the tangible outcomes that we hope from this weekend is that we'll have thousands of people who are now trained to be very proactive activists on the street, and this should amplify our ability to have mass actions in the future. The second thing that we're going to do is we've been having these affinity group spokes councils for the last 6 weeks, where people who have broken up into groups of friends that they trust and share certain types of tactics or political ideals or principles with are deciding for themselves in those small groups what actions they want to carry out, and then working with a spokes council, a sort of horizontal representative body, to decide among themselves how they want the day to proceed, how they want the sort of mass group actions to proceed. And our action framework has come from that. It's been an incredibly directly democratic process. On Saturday, we're going to have what's called an Occupy Town Square. It's this model that we've been using for the last several months, actually the last year, where we go into public parks. And we don't ask for a permit, but we just set up all of the elements that were so vital to Liberty Plaza. So there's the kitchen, there's assemblies, there's a sanitation team, there's speakouts of various kinds, there's performances. And it's all curated by the people who are there. There's no sort of just for like, you know, 8 to 10 hours in the middle of the day. And this is sort of a response. You know, we were kicked out of the park, but now you have to deal with occupations everywhere in every neighborhood of New York whenever you least expect it. One, there's going to be a debtors assembly, which is a new thing we've been doing, which brings together people who have various kinds of debt, student debt, housing debt, credit card debt, medical debt, and sort of gets them to talk about the fact that they are in this debt and the life choices that they make because of this debt. And it helps to build bonds of solidarity and sort of take away the shame of being in debt. And this is part of a long-term project to build a debtors' resistance movement. The other key feature of the Saturday and Sunday events is that while there's all of this stuff going on all at once, there's going to be all these parallel things going on, all these assemblies and performances and whatnot, at certain points during the day they're going to stop. And everything is going to focus on one thing, which is these giant direct action trainings. So really, we're making it very, very clear that the whole reason everyone is there is to go through this training process and focus on the Monday actions. On Saturday night, after the town square, there's going to be a book release. And it's a release of the Debt Resistors Operations Manual. So this is a set of strategies for dealing with debt collectors, for getting out of debt that you might be in default on or in danger of being default on, and for building solidarity with other debtors in your community. And so this is, again, part of that long-term project to build a debtors resistance movement. Sunday is going to be basically the same thing, but it's going to be in a place called Foley Square, which is in front of the federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan. It's a place that's very special to Occupy. It's a place we retreated to after the eviction. There it's going to be another town square event, also with mass direct action trainings and also with a giant spokes council. And it's also going to have a concert, which is going to feature people who are sort of sympathetic to the movement and want to support it by bringing people out to see their performances. And then the night is going to close with a service from members of various different faith traditions who are going to sort of state their support, state their intent to participate in the actions of Monday, and mark the opening of the Jewish holiday of Rosh Hashanah, which starts on Sunday night, which is a time of reflection and repenting for sins and sort of cleansing the old world for the new. It's sort of amazingly appropriate. And then I can go on to Monday, is we're going to express, again, that sort of dual power structure that I talked about earlier. People are going to mass around the New York Stock Exchange, which is both a symbolic and a literal target. And these people are going to come from many different stripes. There's going to be environmental activists there. There's going to be criminal justice activists there. There's going to be healthcare activists there. There's going to be political activists there of every kind. And they're coming together for the realization that, as we say, if you follow the money behind all of our causes, you know, everything that's sort of along this fractured left, you find that all roads lead to Wall Street. And it's symbolic in saying that Wall Street is sort of a euphemism for finance capitalism writ large. But it's also literal, because these five big banks on Wall Street are actually of such a size that they constitute 60% of the American economy. So if you follow the financing behind the gas pipe that's being drilled underneath the West Village right now, you find Chase and Wells Fargo. If you follow the financing behind the private prisons that are imprisoning so many nonviolent drug offenders and people of color in this country, you find the same big banks again and again. And so we're coming together, and what we're literally going to do is just sit in the intersections that surround the stock exchange, and there are barricades that surround the exchange, and they check your ID to make sure that you're one of the people who's allowed to enter the perimeter. And we're going to sit in front of those barricades and just not let people enter. While that's happening, there's going to be many people there. There's going to be veterans and members of clergy and meditators and just activists of every stripe. People are going to spin off and do what's called the 99 revolutions. And so in these sort of dense intersections throughout the financial district, in this space that's been created by all of us uniting towards our one no, they're going to create the space for the many yeses. And they're going to demonstrate what a world of mutual aid might look like, what a world of free education might look like, what a world where people don't have to pay their debts when they're foisted on them by criminal enterprises might look like. And they're going to move from intersection to intersection and hold them as long as they feel comfortable and sort of not try to get arrested in doing so. And then we're all going to come together for a central action around the environment and sort of making very clear these links between finance, capitalism, and environmental destruction. And then we're going to have a spokes council and decide among all of the groups who are there what we want to do next.
How many people are involved in this organizing? Would you say that the one-year anniversary is sparking new interest and motivation? And how long has it been since such a large-scale series of events around Occupy has occurred?
At each planning meeting, we've had weekly planning meetings for a couple of months now. There's between 100 and 200 people who show up. You know, some number of hundreds of other people that organize with those people but don't really like sitting through 4 or 5 hour meetings, which I can't say that I blame them.
For you, what was it that brought you to this moment, to Occupy Wall Street?
I was extraordinarily skeptical when I first heard about it. So I'd been getting the Adbusters things, and I had, there's actually an email thread between myself and a few friends where you know, we were talking about what was happening in London and in Greece and Egypt and Spain. And I asked the question, I said, do you think that could ever happen here? And my response was no. I never thought it could happen here. And the reason I thought it could never happen here is a lot of things, but largely racism. People in the United States are extremely effectively divided by social wedge issues and racism. People who have a very strong common economic and social interest are set apart. And it's quite intentional. There's something called the Southern Strategy, which was implemented by Republican strategists in the late 60s. And they're very open about it. I mean, you can just Google Southern Strategy. It has a Wikipedia page. And they were quite intentional about separating poor working middle-class white people from poor working middle-class black people. And they were very effective at doing that. And I thought that that persisted in such a way that it could never actually lead to a mass movement in this country. And then it happened, And I heard about it, and I'm like, okay, great. Now we have another tea party, but it's on the, quote, left this time. Great. That sounds like the least important thing in the world. And then it stayed. So I didn't go down on the 17th, which was my birthday. I was out with friends. And then I didn't go down the next few days. And then I kept hearing about it, and I'm like, okay, they're still there. I should probably stop by. It's on my way home. So I just went a few blocks out of my way home. And I showed up, and what I saw was a bunch of people standing. It was like 10 o'clock after a General Assembly. There were a bunch of people standing in circles talking about the Glass-Steagall Act and separating investment banks and retail banks. They were talking about Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. They were talking about campaign reform. They were just talking about how to help each other find a place to sleep and find a place to eat and where the bathroom is. And all of these things, just creating a community together, and not only... My whole life, me and my friends have been saying, people are getting stepped on in this country, and they don't seem to care. And not only do they care now, not only did they care enough to put their bodies on the line and sort of build this community sleeping on the concrete in New York City, but they cared enough to go really in depth and figure out what the hell was going on. And I could not possibly turn my back on that. So the very next day, I showed up, and I started sleeping in the park, and I started doing sanitation and kitchen, just whatever I could to help people. And then eventually I started escalating my involvement, and I have ever since.
You were talking about division between colors and social classes. Would you say that that's something within Occupy movement that is actively combated?
Yeah, I think everyone realizes that, you know, these sorts of things are very deeply ingrained. By social conditioning, by history, by just sort of the factors of our environment. And there's an enormous, enormous proactive effort to implement processes that undo that. Is it successful all the time? No, absolutely not. Is it dramatically different from how these sorts of things are handled out in the rest of the world? Absolutely. And it represents the intention and the good faith effort of thousands and thousands of people, and it's one of the more inspiring things that I've seen.
I was in Oakland when they were having their Occupy moment, and the people that I know there, are a lot of them are now involved in anti-foreclosure work, and I'm wondering for yourself in New York City, what are the specific issues that you are now focusing on?
Mainly I'm interested in sort of the social movement aspect of things, where this idea that people feel involved and people feel like they can think for themselves about what sort of world they want to create. But I have been involved in a couple of the more political things, the things that people generally tend to think of as political or concrete results. One of them is an initiative around bank justice. And so what we've found is that there are enormous, we've done some actions involving the Attorney General and the SEC and the Department of Justice, just sort of highlighting the fact that they have absolutely no interest in actually investigating the crimes of the financial crisis. And they're very explicit about this. And I interviewed the former Inspector General of TARP. This is the bailout fund here in the United States. And he flat out said that there's, you know, every single person within these regulatory agencies comes from Goldman Sachs or Chase or Merrill Lynch or something like that. And there's absolutely no way that they're going to do anything but just fine their buddies. It's just completely impossible. And he gave up. He left in part because he felt he could never accomplish anything there. And so what you're finding is that there are actually a number of people within these institutions who are terrified, because they know that not only is what's going on morally deplorable, but it threatens the sustainability of this system. And so we've been getting anonymous tips from many of them, saying things like, it's sort of ironic, but the only thing that I think will save Wall Street is Occupy Wall Street. And so what they're doing is they're telling us about internal investigations that are going on inside the banks. And I don't want to say too much about them because there are some actions coming up that are going to highlight this. But the idea here is that they've lost faith, basically, in the idea that anyone is ever going to prosecute any of these crimes. And so what they want us to do is name and shame people. They want us to create an atmosphere of just social unacceptability for what these people are doing. And so we're going to do that. We're not going to physically touch any of these people or confront any of them, but we're going to make them public. And we're going to make them very, very apparent, make their crimes very, very apparent. And we're going to make the fact that those crimes are not being prosecuted very, very apparent. I'm personally not interested in putting people in jail. I don't think the criminal justice system in this country works or is effective in any way. But I am interested in calling out people who behave in a way that's destructive and, frankly, murderous to others. Another initiative I've been working on is this thing called Strike Debt, and it's this program to build a debtors' resistance movement. And that's gained a lot of traction here in the United States. So we're doing little things right now, like the debt assemblies, which are just incredibly empowering experiences. You see dozens of people just speaking out. Again, like, you know, they don't have experience speaking out and just revealing the shame of being in so much debt. And we have the Debt Resistors Manual, and we're going to start doing trainings of that. So we're going to start teaching people sort of how to overcome their debt, you know, clean things off of their credit report, get rid of things that are in default, fight debt collectors who are hounding them and using violent threats to try and get them to pay up. And then later on, we're going to do this project called the Rolling Jubilee, about which I can't say much right now, but it basically involves the fact that debt collectors, how they get your debt is they buy it on something called the debt market. And they pay between 3 and 10 cents on the dollar for your debt. And so what this means is that the lenders, this is the schools and the hospitals and the credit card companies and so on and so forth, they're actually quite willing to write off your debt. They're just not willing to write it off to you. They're not willing to say to you, okay, we tried to get you to pay. Can you just pay 5 cents on the dollar? And there's a reason for that. They need to keep the moral weapon of debt. They need to say, well, no, you have to pay your debt. And if you don't pay it to us, well, we're going to, you know, write it off, but we're going to make this other guy come after you. And they quite literally do come after you and use very violent tactics to try and get you to pay debt. It's basically the mafia. And do you feel morally obligated to pay your debts back to the mafia? I should hope not. So what we can do then is get on this debt market, because it's open, and we can buy that debt, and we can forgive it. And there's a lot of technicalities in how we do this, and it's going to take a few months to ramp up. But when it does, I think it's going to catch on. And I think people are going to really understand that this debt that they, you know, are rearranging their lives in order to pay is just a number on a book for some faceless corporation, and there's absolutely no reason you have a moral obligation to pay it.
If this debt movement really spread and a lot of people took action and you know, combated paying back this money that they don't feel that they legitimately should pay back, what could happen to the capitalist system as it exists right now?
That's a very good question. I honestly think the effect in real numbers is probably not going to be that much. If you look at what's been going on the last 4 years, we've been bailing out the large banks every single day, provide them 0% interest loans through the discount window, provide them all sorts of regulatory affordances. We allow them to essentially, via something called mark-to-model accounting, literally make up how they want to value their own assets. All of this is costing the American government billions and billions and trillions, literally trillions of dollars. The estimates vary widely. No one really knows. So this bailout sort of thing is already happening, right? The total consumer debt in this country, assuming everyone in the entire country were to somehow default on their debt and never pay it back, it pales in comparison to the corporate debt that we continue to backstop. And they're linked. I mean, the whole reason that we're backstopping these banks is because they have derivatives that are built on all of this consumer debt. And so it's not clear to me that just bailing out the consumer debt or defaulting on the consumer debt or forgiving the consumer debt is really going to do a single thing it's going to make much of a dent to the balance sheets of these giant banks. But it is going to change the way that people operate within capitalism. And I think that's the most important effect. And that will be what changes capitalism if it occurs. I think it'll make people reassess what the meaning of debt is. You know, debt is sold to us as a way to sort of help you pay for things that you couldn't otherwise afford. But really what it's become is a way to help you keep paying for things that you need. If you look at the prices of things like education and healthcare and housing, they've skyrocketed in line, in direct proportion to the ease of creating credit in those markets. So these are things like mortgage-backed securities in the housing market directly drove up the prices of houses because the credit was so easy to provide and so risk-free for the banks that they could just foist it on anyone. And so everyone would take larger and larger and larger mortgages. The exact same thing is happening in students and student loans here in the United States. We have these things called student loan asset-backed securities. And I graduated college in 2003. I now teach at a college that's a similar tier. When I graduated, I had about $100,000 in debt. The students at my school right now who graduate paying full price, which is many of them, will have over $200,000 in debt. The cost of providing an education has not doubled in the past 10 years. It's just simply impossible. The price of it has doubled. And the reason the price has doubled, a very large part of the reason the price has doubled, is because they can simply get away with charging more because student loan credit is so easy to provide and so risk-free for them.
Do you want to talk on that same topic about some support solidarity work that Occupy Wall Street did while there was the Quebec student strike going on?
Yeah, we were so inspired. Me personally and all the people I knew around me, so inspired by what was going on in Quebec, not just because of the issue and not just because that you chose to take a stand at a point at which people in this country, you know, the idea of going from, what was it, $2,500 to $3,100 or something like that?
Yes.
The idea of that, you know, that dollar amount was absurd to some people in this country, but it was inspiring to many of us who said, no, they are taking the stand at exactly the right point. And they're pushing for free education. That's exactly the right way to do it, because you don't want to be locked in the same spiral that we are. We have spiraled so close to death in this country before we finally realized that we could stand up. And you took the lead, really. And that's amazing to us. So what we did here in New York is still ongoing. We first just started with solidarity marches. On the 22nd, there was a very large solidarity march that instantly went to the streets and just surprised everyone in how large it was and how uniform the support was. So it started around NYU. And it passed by the faculty housing at NYU, and we were banging our pots and pans. And then you could see the people coming out of the windows in the faculty houses banging their pots and pans as well, because they knew what it was about. And I wear my red square around New York City. There was a series of marches where we went kind of all over the city. They were first weekly, and then daily, and then weekly, and now monthly again. And I wear my red square, and people stop me all the time, either people from Montreal or people who know about it, and they just say thank you. And that expression of solidarity, not just to Montreal, but to Mexico and to all of the countries around the world that are rising up, is one of the most fascinating things to me about this moment that we're in. It really feels like this is, yes, we fight about local issues, like you focused on the tuition increase, but there is a sense that what we're doing here has a strong commonality, that we're really finding a way, a new vocabulary for where people actually have direct democratic control over the way their lives are run. And it's expressing itself in many different ways, from Egypt to Greece to London to Montreal to Mexico to New York. But the common vocabulary that we're building, and I think we're not there yet, and it's going to take years to do it, is one of the most exciting things I've ever seen in my entire life.
And what would you like to do next? What do you hope S17 will lead to?
I hope that it will do what we've continued to do. I think so much of what we've done this last year has come from the simple fact that people saw that there were people willing to stand up and say no, and that there was space for them to fill that in with all of their different yeses. All of these different ways, I mean, the incredible solidarity that's happening now in the labor movement here in the United States. A few months ago, we had a lockout of workers at Con Edison, the electrical utility, in New York. And you found workers from the building janitors to the transit workers to the communications workers attend a rally together and say, I'm not going to pay my electric bill until they let these workers back to work and give them a fair contract. I'm not going to transport equipment to Con Ed until these workers get a fair contract. That sort of stuff has not happened in the United States for 60 years or more. And it's happening now because people realize that this moment that we're in there's millions of people who want to stand up together.
Aaron is speaking to us from New York City. Thank you so much for doing this interview.